Hello, and welcome to another historical podcast. Again, it's myself, Matt Nelson, and Wayne Bridgman. And,
hello.
Yes, and I hope you guys out there have been well since the last one. So this is actually part two of a multi-part podcast on the Battle of Little...
Multi-part being two parts.
Two parts, yes.
Don't worry, it's not going to go more than two parts.
Yes, it is actually just two parts, good point. And... we had some really good feedback from the last one, so thanks very much for that. The feedback was keep putting the photos on Twitter and Instagram because they put some nice context into, you know, some of the things we were describing here. But Wayne, where do we get to in episode one?
Well, actually, just to add to Matt's point there about feedback, we do pay attention to it, and it has actually been really useful, you know, in guiding us where we're going to go with this podcast. So please keep it coming; it's great. Where did we get to though, Matt? Well, we were talking about the westward expansion,
yeah,
and the effect that had obviously on eating into the Native Americans' country, their land, as it was perceived.
Displacing all the Indians, yeah.
Yeah, that would happen naturally. We talked about the Civil War and the role that played insofar as it gave that westward expansion a real turbo boost.
Yes, as the reunited states unified transcontinental railway.
That's right, and of course, one of the main protagonists, General George Custer. What a guy. And who was he aligned against, Matt, on the Native American side?
Okay, well, he was aligned against the Nations of the Sioux.
Yeah, but who specifically was the Big Cheese?
Well, Sitting Bull and the Crazy Horse.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so just to put the context of why this had happened, Custer had led an expedition into the Black Mountains. He'd discovered gold. They wanted a mine on that because they wanted to bring the gold out of there. So it was a gold rush, formed the town of Deadwood. The Indians obviously didn't want that to happen. This was a spiritual place. There was a point of no return for them. So they had said, you know, we're not going to go into the reservations. We're going to gather at a place and we're going to gather all these Indian nations together. And that's what they were doing at the moment. They were bringing the Indian forces together. And at the same time, the American generals were pulling their armies together to meet the Indians in battle. So in March that year, as three columns of federal troops under General George Crook, General Alfred Terry, and Colonel John Gibbon moved into the area of the Black Hills to take this insurrection from the Indians down. So a bit about US battle strategy here against the Indians. Terry, who had overall command, had a tried and tested plan at his fingertips. What had worked against the Indians in the past was to secretly locate the camp where the Indians were located.
Shoot them.
No.
Shoot them.
Divide the force you had into three and attack at once at the three different locations around the camp. Now, when you bring in the technology like Gatling guns, Henry and Winchester repeating rifles...
Devastating.
You're obviously going to be winning. Mm. So when the Native Americans try to flee, the other two columns then intercept them. They cut off their retreat, essentially envelop them. Massacre or essentially can capture them all. There's no escape.
Mm. A foolproof plan that rarely failed. After all, Indians were savages with outmoded weapons and never gathered in groups large enough to worry the government troops. So this was a tried and tested central thought behind Terry's strategy here. But what scared the government troops the most? Not being killed. Different times. No, they feared... if they attack the Indians, they might have enough time to escape.
So they didn't even contemplate losing then?
No, well, losing wasn't in these guys' DNA. You know, these are tough boys. Not in their thought process at all. In their minds, it was either all-out victory for them or the Indians escaped. And it was a failure.
Right, okay. So that made them take risks, I'd imagine, then, as they believed too much in the superiority of their technology over that of the Indian skill in the terrain.
They may have underestimated them, yes. Meanwhile, at the Sioux encampment, Sitting Bull summoned the Lakota, Cheyenne, and Arapaho to his camp on Rosebud Creek in Montana Territory. There, he led them in the Sundance ritual. It's nice, isn't it? Have a little dance before a battle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and in reality, of course, they were summoning the spirits, working themselves up into a lathered frenzy, offering prayers to Wanka Katankananka, I think is that his name?
Wakantanka.
Wakantanka, thank you.
The great spirit.
Yes, yep. He sounds like a great spirit. And slashing his arms 100 times as a sign of sacrifice.
So
these guys meant
business. Slashing his arms, it's a lot of blood, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. The blood that spilled onto the blanket he sat upon was called the Scarlet Blanket. And that was offered to, Matt?
Wackentanker.
Thank you. Why did he do this? Sounds a bit primitive. Certainly would have been if the Americans were watching on, but it had profound meaning to them.
Yes, it certainly did. You know, essentially why they did this, the Indians felt that Wackentanker had given them everything in life. In fact, the only thing they truly owned was their bodies. So the only thing they could give Wackentanker that meant anything was their flesh from their bodies. So in this Sundance, Sitting Bull makes a sacrifice of his flesh to ask for victory in the coming battle. This lasted 2 days and involved Sitting Bull essentially dancing for 48 hours before collapsing and seeing a vision of the future battle.
Yeah, that happened to me in my younger days.
Yes, exactly, yes. It's the Moon Dance Festival in Thailand. The vision in which he saw the soldiers falling down and killed, like grasshoppers falling from the sky. The vision of victory sent the Sioux into a foaming frenzy of excitement. But Sitting Bull said the vision had also shown something else. Let's go back there and find out what it was.
These soldiers are gifts of Wackentanker. Kill them, but do not take their guns or horses. Do not harm their bodies. If you set your hearts upon the goods of white man, it will be a curse upon you. Where's my pipe? Wow, the ambiance created there. It's almost like being there, isn't it?
Yeah, almost as if you were really there.
In the room.
Or the war dance. Inspired by this vision, the war chief, Crazy Horse, set out for the battle with a band of 1,000 warriors.
Nice round figure.
On June the 17th, he surprised Crook's troops. Remember, this was the flanking troop that...
They'd gone out some days before, hadn't they?
They'd gone out a few days before. They were going to go on one side, Gibbon on the next, and then Custer's lot through the middle. So he intercepted Crook's troops.
On Gibbon, I think he just swung through the trees, didn't he? On the right flank.
Okay, and they had a battle. It's called the Battle of the Rosebud, and they fought all day. Crazy Horse kept driving, using different Indian tactics. It surprised Crook by the ferocity of the Indians. Although he did drive the Indians back, actually the Indians called it a victory for themselves. But he was so surprised, Crook, by the ferocity of this fight with Crazy Horse, that he basically did not advance. Remember, he's a flanking... It's pretty vital that he does advance, but he didn't advance.
He thought he won. There was an advantage to be had by trying to chase them down, but no, he didn't advance, did he? What did he do?
He made camp for 7 weeks and waited for supplies to arrive.
So, okay, well, it doesn't sound like he was eager to face those guys again.
No.
I think the native warriors may have out-ball-sized him.
Yeah.
So, yes, he basically bricked it, didn't he?
But Wayne, tell us more about the actual difference of the different tactics that Crazy Horse used.
Well, yes, so he was used to, actually, the Indians not fighting in conventional ways and fighting guerrilla warfare. Maybe he should have left it to Gibbon. but this band of Sioux and Cheyenne fought to win. Big difference, and attacked in waves. So it's not hit and run. They're standing up toe-to-toe and they're fighting with these guys.
Yep.
Short range, aggressive. He was also not expecting a large group of Indians to stay together for so long. You know, they were coordinated here. They're pooling their resources. It was a belief that Indians, due to their rivalries and need to hunt and remain in small groups, wouldn't do this. So 1,000 crazed, foaming Indians all attacking at once really unnerved Crook, actually. And he and his equal number of 1,000 or so troops never, therefore, arrived at the Battle of Little Bighorn. That was fought a week later. What made this issue worse was that he did not send a message to the other columns that his column wouldn't be there. He didn't tell them.
Man, that's crazy.
So the other two commanders, General Terry and Gibbon, were completely unaware this had happened.
Well, knowledge is power in this type of situation. However, another issue assaulted the government troops. The third column under Colonel Gibbon had been delayed leaving fort by snowfall, and his progress was weeks behind where he should have been. So he's running late. this guy Crook's not even coming.
Not looking good.
Yeah, so the only column out of the three that was actually marching on the Sioux was the 1,000-plus men under General Terry. Custer was there with his 7th Cavalry, his vaulted, famous 7th Cavalry, which made up about, basically about 600 to 700 of the men in Terry's 1,000. Terry had given orders that Custer take his men and scout ahead to locate the Indians.
Now, the orders that Terry gave to Custer were actually discretionary.
Mm-hmm.
It was implied, therefore, that Custer could use his battlefield judgment, in inverted commas, if he discovered the Indians. And, of course, that suited Custer pretty well, as he was a seat-of-your-pants kind of guy, bit of a self-publicist.
So Custer and his 7th Cavalry went ahead of Terry's column and were essentially the scouting advance party with the remit to track down the Indian camp, notify Terry when they track the Indian camp, and then the three columns to converge.
Makes
we
sense.
Know, of course,
Makes
the two
sense.
Columns are not coming, though. Speed for Custer was key, and he made decisions before they set out that would have a huge impact to his men's fighting chances at the Battle of Little Bighorn River. These decisions were not popular with his men, and especially Colonel Benteen, who was not a fan of Custer since the Battle of Wichita. Gentlemen! There's a lot of Indians waiting for us, but I want each of you men to carry 100 rounds carbine, 100 rounds pistol ammunition. Your rations are 15 days per man. Take extra salt if you want it. 50 rounds per man additionally goes on the mule train, yes sirree.
So we can carry more than 15 days rations on the supply wagon, sir. We can't go to war so lightly armed and provisioned, not this far in
Thank
state.
You, thank you for your opinion, Benteen. Not! We ain't taking wagons. All that goes with us goes on the mule trains, Benteen.
No wagons, sir? God damn it, that's crazy. How are we gonna haul the big guns? Any man who don't take weapons gotta be mighty brave or mighty stupid. Which one will we be, sir?
Well, Benteen, I know you'd be stupid if you be questioning my orders. Don't you go getting crazy on me, Colonel Benteen. We're hunting Indians, not cattle. We gotta go fast. We gotta go mobile. You wanna catch Indians, you travel as they do. One more thing. We don't pack sabers and we don't take Gatling guns.
No sabres or Gatling guns, sir? God damn it. What are we going to do if we get up close and personal with these Indians, sir? They got those little sharp axes and shit. Are we going to use harsh language on them? I know you brought up too good for that to work.
Sabres rattled, Benteen, and when we ride Gatling guns cost us time. Colonel Benteen, we give our position away. No more of this insolence, Benteen. You don't travel, you don't hold me back. I won't have a single Indian say he escaped the 7th Cavalry. Yeehaw!
Yes, sir. We're going to live to regret this.
But it was not just those rations that caused disquiet within the men. One, due to a need to travel faster than an Indian, he refused to take along the weapons of the age, his big advantage, the Gatling gun. I'm sure everyone knows, but that's basically the first sort of mechanical repeating rifle of the day, a machine gun, effectively. And I can get that speed is the key when tracking Indians down. An Indian unit could travel 28 miles per day. So Custer's cavalry needed to travel 30 to catch and overhaul them. But with Gatling guns in tow, he'd be travelling about 12 miles a day.
So it made sense. He was also offered four more companies of cavalry, but Custer turned them down. He was loyal to the 7th, and he believed, "Here, I can whip any Indian village on the plains with my own men of the 7th.
Meanwhile, the Sioux moved their camp to the valley of the Little Bighorn River, where they were joined by 3,000 more Indians now, who had come down from their reservations to follow Chief Sitting Bull.
Custer, way out in front of Terry's column on the morning of the 25th of June at 8 a.m., is told by his Indian scouts that a large village has been spotted 12 miles away, and the village looks peaceful and asleep. Because of the mobile nature of Great Plains warfare, he had to act fast, cut off the escape routes.
Bloody Naff, you report in here what you see out there.
Cluster, sir. We see vast village with Redskin braves. Will we find enough Sioux and Cheyenne braves to keep us fighting for 3 days solid?
Yeah. Hell no, don't you worry about that, Bloody Naff. I think we'll get through these guys in one day. Oh, yes.
You kidding, right?
No, sir. No,
we're sold to these guys. Both you and I are going home today by a road we do not know. I shall not see you rest in this war tonight, General. I will soon see Watton...
He's Wacken Tanker, I believe, Bloody Naff.
Thank you, General. I'll see him, I fear.
Bloody Naff, you just see here. We caught these boys a-napping. Hey, boys! We caught the Indians a-napping! Let's finish these boys up and we'll go home.
Custer, in a mini version of Terry's overall plan, if you remember, divided his forces into 3 battalions. One led by Major Marcus Reno, one by Captain Frederick Benteen, and one by himself. Now, as we alluded to earlier, it does sound not necessarily the best thing to do to split up such a small force into multiple parts. But remember, the belief that the government forces can't lose this forthcoming battle, and the fact they underestimated the Indians, and the fact they didn't know the Sioux had over 2,000 warriors. I mean, they think that maybe tops out at about 800, you know. But it was vastly more than had ever been assembled in the past.
It's a good point. And also the Sioux had better weapons. This is perhaps not known, but it's believed that 1 in 5 Sioux had traded to have the Winchester repeating rifles, whereas Custer's men had only single-shot Springfield carbines. So the Indians were packing serious heat.
So Benteen was sent south and west to cut off any attempt at escape by the Indians. Reno was sent north to charge the southern flank of the encampment. And Custer rode north, hidden to the east of the encampment by bluffs, actually, and he was planning to circle around and attack from the north.
Take them hard from behind.
Boom!
Boom. So, the battle begins when Reno and his 140 troops begin a charge on the southern end of the village. But they're halted some 500 to 600 yards away from the Sioux camp. And his men dismount and form a skirmish line. Essentially, this is about 10 metres apart, rifle, horse next to them, and that's essentially a skirmish line. And they were soon overcome by mounted Lakota and Cheyenne warriors, though, who counterattacked en masse against Reno's exposed left flank. It forced Reno and his men to take cover in the trees along the riverbed. Eventually, however, this position became untenable, and the troops were forced into a bloody retreat up into the bluffs where supposedly Custer was, above the river, where they made their own stand. This, the opening action of the battle, it cost Reno a quarter of his command, so of the 140 men died in that
isn't
encounter.
Isn't pleasant casualties to any general. But that said, Matt, Custer... I'd have thought he would have seen Reno stop and form that skirmish line. We don't know whether the Indians, whether they'd put something down on the ground to disrupt the charge of that cavalry and hence they had to dismount, or whether it was just bad planning, who knows. But anyway, Custer led his command to the northern end of that main Indian encampment, where he apparently planned to sandwich, or pincer, mm-hmm. I think most people call it, the Indians between his attacking troopers and Reno's command who were fighting that defensive battle. The idea was that classic sort of hammer and anvil manoeuvre, you know, but with Reno's troops in this state, I'm not sure how effective this is going to be. So, for whatever reason, this never happened. As they say, many plans never survive contact with the enemy. And Reno was actually pinned down and joined later by Benteen. I guess whether it was calling for reinforcements, we don't quite know, but Benteen was criticised after the battle for not coming to Custer's rescue.
Actually, Wayne, based on some testimony from the Cheyenne warriors that survived the battle, they saw some of Custer's command attempt to ford the river that Reno was fighting near, but to the north end of it, and tried to get into the camp. And the plan was, as had been seen at the Battle of Wichita, was to capture the women and children.
Human shields, yeah, get in there, try and deliver a killing blow.
Yeah. Well, if he had succeeded, he may well have won the Battle of the Little Bighorn. He would have drawn with the children and used them as bargaining chips.
Proven method, to make them surrender. Why not try and do it again?
So, yeah, so they did attempt to do that, there is belief.
Well, it might have been a nice idea for Custer to try and do that, but his troops were driven off by stiff resistance from the Indian sharpshooters firing from the brush along the west bank of the riverbed.
Yeah.
And from that point, the soldiers were pursued by hundreds, they say, of warriors onto a ridge north of the encampment. So at least we know that they could retreat in a controlled manner uphill onto a ridge.
Yeah, there was still order within the ranks at that point.
There was. Don't forget, these are seasoned warriors, these guys. They've been through the Civil War. So Custer and his command were prevented from digging in by Crazy Horse, however, whose warriors had outflanked him and were now to his north at the crest of the ridge.
So above him.
Above him and in a position to harry him.
Well, being flanked is never a good thing. So Custer is being forced to withdraw with his men on foot, and they look up higher and they look to get to higher ground and await support from Benting. But halfway up the ridge, they look up, Crazy Horse appears at the top and descends down on top of him, trapping him between the two Indian forces.
Now, perhaps this is where local knowledge of the terrain is coming in handy.
Yes, indeed.
So, for a time, and this is quite a bad position now, it doesn't like to turn out to be, but for a time, Custer's men appeared to have been deployed by company. So that's a standard cavalry fighting formation at the time. So you've got a skirmish line with every fourth man holding horses.
Mm-hmm.
If you need to make a quick getaway or a counterattack or whatever, those horses need to be right there so you can jump onto those beasts.
Mm-hmm.
Although that arrangement would have robbed Custer of a quarter of his firepower, of course. Every fourth man, a quarter of the guys, is to be standing there holding horses, trying to keep them calm. However, it's believed panic took over at this point, Mark.
Yeah, well, you could imagine. It's all not gone according to plan so far for him. So Crazy Horse led a mounted charge that broke through the centre of Custer's line. So he's coming down the hill with a mounted charge into Custer's line. Pandemonium broke out among the soldiers. According to some Lakota Sioux accounts, many of the panicking soldiers threw down their weapons and either rode or ran towards a knoll where Custer was and some of the other officers were. About 40 men were making a sort of final stand there. Along the way, the warriors, the Indian warriors, that is, rode them down, so they never got there.
I mean, you can just imagine, can't you, the confusion and terror this must have caused. These guys thought, we're going on the attack, we're attacking these savages, should be a quick hammer blow victory.
We caught them napping, but they didn't.
Well, they weren't napping. They were very much awake and aggressive. And
in numbers.
The tables have been turned. The guys are on foot. The cavalry guys are on foot. You've got these wild men who actually turn out to be damn good shots as well, riding all around them. Their friends are falling beside them. You know, absolute chaos.
Yeah.
So as the troopers were cut down, the native warriors stripped the dead of their firearms and ammunition, so you can't use that either.
Yeah.
With the result that the return fire from the cavalry, of course, would happen. It would steadily decrease.
Yeah. Less people would shoot.
Yeah. So while the fire from the Indians, what would happen?
Constantly increase.
It would increase, indeed. Yeah. So the surviving troopers apparently shot the remaining horses to use as sort of like a breastwork, you know, for a final
like
stand.
Defensive lines, basically, of horse bodies.
Yeah. And that is really the last.
Well, you know you can't get away at that point, and you've shot your only escape vehicle, so you know you're going down.
And they're going to take that final stand on the knoll at the top of that, or as close as they can get to the top of that ridge at the north end. Now, the Native American warriors, they sense blood. They can see there's a kill here in the offing. They're going to have a decisive victory, so they start to close in for the final attack, and ultimately killed every man in Custer's command, including, as we probably all know, Custer himself. As a result of this, the Battle of the Little Bighorn has come to popularly be known as, what is it, Matt?
Custer's last stand.
It certainly was.
Yes. Now, some eyewitness reports state that Custer was not identified until after his death by the Native Americans who killed him. Several individuals claimed personal responsibility for the killing of Custer, including White Bull, Rain in the Face.
Nice name.
Flat Lip.
Not so good.
Brave Bear.
Excellent.
Yeah. And of course, Broken Rubber.
Father to many brave warriors.
Indeed. Now, In June 2005, at a public meeting, the Northern Cheyenne broke more than 100 years, Wayne, 100 years of silence about the battle.
That's a lot of silence.
They don't
talk
about...
The potential to forget.
Yeah,
that
well, they don't have loose tongues.
No.
Storytellers said that, according to their oral traditions, because they passed it down word of mouth, Buffalo Calf Road woman, a Northern Cheyenne heroine of the Battle of the Rosebud, the one that was fought earlier, stuck the final blow into Custer, which knocked him off his horse before he died.
Oh, right. So just to add insult to injury, he was taken out by a young lady.
Buffalo Calf Road woman.
Of course, nothing wrong with that, but they were very different times.
Yeah.
Right, anyway, so now during, moving forward a bit now, Matt, during the 1920s, two elderly Cheyenne women again spoke briefly with oral historians. Don't, Matt, remember, that just means to pass down word of mouth, not written, about having their having recognised Custer's body on the battlefield itself, and had actually stopped a Sioux warrior from desecrating the body. I'm not quite sure what they do to desecrate the bodies, but some sort of mutilation,
pretty,
probably.
Pretty horrible, you know, stuff, yeah.
The women were relatives of someone called Mona Sitar, who was alleged to have been Custer's one-time lover.
I
so he's got history with these guys.
Yeah.
In the Cheyenne culture of the time, such a relationship was considered a marriage, Matt. You've been there once, you're going to be there for good. They believed in monogamous relationships, the Indians, I imagine. So the women allegedly told the warrior to stop. He's a relative of ours. In Native American. Yeah. And then shooed him away. The two women then shoved their sewing awls into their ears, like big knitting needles,
Jesus,
to permit Custer's corpse to hear better in the afterlife. That's the excuse they give. Because he had broken his promise to Chief Stone Forehead, that's a real name, never to fight against Native Americans. So they were pissed.
Yeah, they were pissed. So when the main column under General Terry arrived 2 days later, because remember Custer was ahead of Terry and maybe he should have stopped, but speed was of the essence, the army found most of the soldiers' bodies stripped, scalped and mutilated.
Nasty.
Custer's body had two bullet holes in it, one in the left temple and one just above the heart.
That'll do it.
Captain Benteen, who inspected the body, stated that in his opinion the fatal injuries had not been the result of a .45 caliber ammunition, which implies the bullet holes had been caused by ranged rifle fire. Following the recovery of Custer's body and that of his brother Tom, the remains were buried on a battlefield, side by side in a shallow grave, after being covered by pieces of tent canvas and blankets.
Yeah, and actually, if you can go to that site today in the States, and there's gravestones there,
yes,
on that ridge.
Yeah, Custer's last stand.
Yeah, yeah. And it's and they're placed where all of his men actually fell. And if you can Google that right now, you know, Custer's gravesite or something like that.
Yeah, Custer's stand, it will have it all there. Yeah,
yeah, and you can see, actually, looking at that hill, how everyone's sort of scattered haphazardly. And it starts further down the hill, there's fewer. But as you get closer to the top of the hill, obviously they're retreating, it gets denser, those tombstones. So
they run out of places to run.
Yeah, desperate struggle. So, the aftermath. Well, President Grant, a highly successful general himself, actually, bluntly criticised Custer's actions at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, and he was quoted in the New York Herald on September the 2nd, 1876, as saying, Matt, if you could.
Our guy Custer's massacre is a sacrifice of troops, brought on by Custer himself, and was wholly unnecessary. Wholly unnecessary.
Easy to say with the benefit of hindsight, of course, but he
of
makes
course
a good point.
Custer could have been successful if he got the women and children. General Philip Sheridan likewise took a harsh view on Custer's final military actions as well. Major Reno's failure to press his attack on the south end of the Lakota Cheyenne village and his flight along the river have been cited as a factor in the destruction of Custer's battalion, as has Captain...
That plan, I think, it's too complicated, wasn't it? There were so many moving parts in that plan.
Well, yeah,
take
and
one out, it all falls apart.
And also, it relied on the fact that the Cheyenne and the Sioux weren't ready for them, and didn't have, you know, they caught them napping. They didn't. They were ready.
Experienced guys themselves.
You know? Yeah. And as Captain Frederick Benteen also got some shit over this, allegedly his tardy arrival to the field of battle, the failure of both officers combined, forces to move towards the relief of Custer. You know, so what they were saying there is both Reno and Benteen could have helped Custer out potentially, certainly Benteen, but he never arrived to help him.
Yeah, but Custer's defenders, however, he does have them, have said that Gatling guns would have been slow and cumbersome. Remember, he didn't want to take them with him. As the troops crossed the rough country between the Yellowstone and the Little Bighorn area, Custer rated speed in gaining the battlefield as essential. And remember, you're up against fast guys yourselves. You know, if you're dragging Gatling guns behind you, it's going to throw up the dust. They're going to see you coming.
Yep,
so that speed is essential and more important than the firepower in this case. And the additional firepower had the potential of turning the tide of the fight if you can get them into place, if you can get them set up, if you can get them fed with ammunition. Giving the Indians propensity for withdrawing in the face of new military technology, they might have gone before they had the chance to corral them, you know, and finish them off. Know.
And no one knew they had the Winchester rifles. You know, the Indians had been trading these secretly, and they had a stash of rifles that were more than they actually had the military advantage over Custer.
Yeah. Well, and also, actually, other Custer supporters have claimed that splitting the forces, that was a standard tactic. We've seen it before. Mm. We talked about it earlier.
Yeah.
So as to demoralise the enemy with the appearance of the cavalry in different places all at once, especially when a contingent threatened the line of retreat. Remember, there's the anvil, defensive line, sweep in, boom.
Hammer. Yeah, hammer. After the Custer force was annihilated, the Lakota and Northern Cheyenne regrouped to attack Reno and Benteen. So the same day, the Battle of Bighorn. This then fight continued until approximately 9 p.m. at night. And for much of the next day, with the outcome of the battle in doubt, Reno credited actually Benteen's leadership at that time for repulsing a severe attack at one portion of the perimeter of the area they were defending.
On June 27th, the column under General Terry approached from the north, and the Indians withdrew off in the opposite direction, as they might. The Crow Scout White Man Runs Him.
Now,
I wonder who gave him that name.
Well, exactly.
Maybe the opposition.
Yeah, exactly. It's a pretty bad name, isn't it?
Yeah. He was the first to tell General Terry's officers that Custer's force had been, and I quote, wiped out. Reno and Benteen's wounded troops were given what treatment was available at the time. Remember, they're in the field there.
Yeah, but from the Indian perspective, the aftermath of the Battle of the Little Bighorn had far-reaching consequences, Wayne. Far-reaching. It was the beginning of the end of the Indian Wars, but not in the way we might think about it, because it's actually been referred to as the Plains Indians' last stand, as much as it was Custer's.
So it incited such a reaction from the American
state. It was a bit like Pearl Harbor in a lot of ways. It made America sit up and go,
coalesced all those
one of our
poster, against them, didn't it?
Yeah, well, one of the poster children of the sort of Civil War, you know, he's been killed.
Well, if you want to poke someone with a patriotism stick, the best way to do that is to kill and mutilate their troops.
Yeah, exactly.
Get that in the papers.
Within 48 hours after the battle, the large encampment of the Little Bighorn broke up into smaller groups, as the resources of grass for the horses and game could not sustain...
Bless you!
Could not sustain the large congregation, Wayne, of people.
I like that. Keep it in. Add a human touch.
We'll add the sneeze. Shall we keep the sneezing? Yeah,
keep it in. Add a human touch.
So just the sneeze might have put us all off there. But what essentially was that, you know, the Indians...
I don't want to get bogged down too much with the sneeze.
The point I was trying to say is the Indians couldn't sustain being together. There wasn't enough food supplies. They had to depart.
Ah, right, okay. Good point. Yeah. Well made. The scattered Sioux and Cheyenne from that point then feasted and celebrated during July with no threat from soldiers. There'd soon be a threat to come their way, that's for sure. After their celebrations, many of the Indians slipped back to the reservations where the American government knew exactly where they were, perhaps sensing that the summer of 1876 would be the last of their traditional lives. They must have known that they'd injured the beast. Mm-hmm. And it was going to come back very angry, looking for some revenge.
Flick the testicle of the bull.
Yes, that's what they did. Not very wise. Soon, the number of warriors who still remained at large and hostile amounted only to about 600. So these guys are starting to melt away now. You know, get out of here, save yourselves.
Both Crook and Terry remained immobile for 7 weeks after the Battle of Bighorn. awaiting reinforcements and unwilling to venture out against the Indians until they had at least 2,000 men. So they properly grabbed him.
Been spooked.
Yeah.
Crook and Terry finally took the field against the Indians in August. In May 1877, Sitting Bull escaped to Canada. Typical.
Mm-hmm.
And within days, Crazy Horse surrendered at Fort Robinson. He was taken into a courthouse, stabbed when he tried to flee, and eventually he was shot dead. So, you know, he wasn't aware that the way that the white men worked. You know, he thought he was maybe trying to negotiate with these guys. They weren't interested.
Too dangerous to be kept alive.
That's what happens to you. The Great Sioux War therefore ended on May the 7th with the defeat of the remaining ragtag band of Sioux.
Yeah. And as for the Black Hills, the Many Penny Commission structured an arrangement in which the Sioux would cede the land to the United States government.
At a very good price, no doubt.
Yeah, or they would cease to supply rations to the reservations. So threatened with starvation, the Indians ceded them to the United States. But the Sioux never accepted the legitimacy of this transaction. After lobbying Congress, Wayne, mm-hmm. to create a forum to decide their claim, a subsequent litigation spanning 40 years,
wow.
United States Supreme Court in 1980 made a decision of United States versus the Sioux Nation to acknowledge to the Indians that the Black Hills had been taken without the proper compensation given
so
to them.
So were they then subsequently offered something?
They were, but the Sioux being the Sioux, proud people even now, refused the money offered and continued to insist it was actually what they wanted was to occupy the land.
I was going
to
say, well, that's a waste of time, they've refused the compensation. But if they're saying, we're not interested in the money, it's our land, we want that statement made, we want it written down in black and white, so at least we can get something out of this struggle that's been gone for so long.
Mm.
But they didn't get it, Matt. But then I suppose that's how the story of conquering ends, when stronger peoples come up against weaker ones in the struggle for land and resources. It's the ultimate and only ending for them.
Yes. So this was the end of the Indian way of life, as we know it for the Sioux. Other tribes fought on for longer, but soon the war with the Native Americans in America was over.
And as if to reiterate the sad end of that noble race, Chief Sitting Bull ended his days in a circus. Buffalo Bill's circus. Traveling. I don't know, riding a zebra or something, possibly.
No, he was reenacting the Battle of Little Bighorn. And, you know, so
forced
very
to
sad.
Relive that terrible time of his people. Horrible, horrible.
Yeah, yeah. So that concludes the podcast.
Nice to end on a happy note.
Absolutely. And I hope you enjoyed it. Again, you know, we appreciate your feedback. We're looking at doing some different subjects now.
Maybe a sneak peek of the next podcast. Is that, yeah, we're actually getting quite organised now. Yep. Is that we're going to look at the top 10, or at least what we think is the top 10 ancient special forces of all time. Tantalising. We'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah.
It's going to be another 10-parter, but that's what we feel is coming up next.
Yes.
Again, that suggestion came from you guys. So if you've got more things you'd like us to discuss, any interesting historical event whatsoever, then please send it through.
And once again, thank you for listening.
So as they say in Native American, goodbye, or ana, or as they say in, I don't know, perhaps Italian, Matt?
Okay. I surrender, not in the face, not in the face.
That actually meant arrivederci.
Oh, sorry, I didn't know what you mean. Okay.
Arrivederci, not in the face, not in the face.